Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller, and we just heard a welcome song from the Messenger Feast, sung by Charlie Jensen of Kivalina and Lucy Jensen of Point Hope. The words, freely translated, are, "It's a happy time, a very happy time, when ducks are flying. As they return to the tundra in the spring, they greet each other." I'm reading all this from an illustrated booklet that accompanies a record of Alaskan Eskimo songs and stories. It was put together from tapes made by Lorraine de Caranda when she was with the music department at the University of Alaska here in Fairbanks. Some of the money to publish the book and record came from British Petroleum Alaska. That was before BP and Sohio merged. Carolyn Dowling of the Sohio Public Relations Office explains how Caranda got the project started.
She made tapes around the state of Alaska beginning in 1950 through 1964, and she approached the Festival of Music and British Petroleum Alaska Incorporated to fund this, and they were pleased to do so. It's a shame we haven't had a follow-up offer from somebody, and I don't know whether there would be anything that much changed or anything that was not done. Perhaps other Native groups mm-hmm. could look into doing something similar to this, but she felt at the time that she was compiling these tapes that the culture was being lost rapidly enough that she had to do it then. Some of the people that she... In fact, I think she said all but one who contributed was born before the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. So she really got some of the old stuff. And the people, according to this preface here, were very, very pleased to share. And they gave songs and stories to her that were not available to the general public, either anthropologist or, as she says, ethnomusicologist. So she must have really spent quite a bit of time out in the bush talking with the people to get them to contribute to this where they hadn't to other things. Do you know how the records have been received? Well, the one comment that I have heard came from someone that was in Barrow, and the record was taken over to someone's house, and they started playing it, and all the old people started gathering, and they danced continuously, I understand, for about 6 hours. And I don't know if they wore the record out, but I want to stress that if anyone would like to get copies of the tapes, we're going to leave this one here with KUAC, happily. And there's no problem, as far as we know, with copywriting restrictions. It's copyright is held by the Alaska Festival of Music, but any Ohio doesn't have any concern. We're delighted, in fact, to see this sent out as far as it can go. There are some here at the university which we sent last year to Dr. Tom Johnston for his Eskimo music class, and I think that they are available I know that the Barrel radio station and television station has some. I don't know what the distribution was. Assuming that all the schools had them, they should still be there. If they aren't, perhaps they could contact us at SOHIO in Anchorage, Public Affairs Office, and we'll see what we can do. There are not that many copies of the record left. Yeah, there really aren't. And I've been very careful in giving some to KUAC's record library. I was surprised you didn't have one, but delighted to contribute where there wasn't, and sent one out to Kotzebue, to the Native Center out there. So just whatever we have available, we'll give them out until the last one's gone.
The songs and stories on the record are from Inupiaq and Yupik areas. They're divided up into categories including weather and power songs, shaman songs, hunting songs, games, rituals, stories, and dancing songs. We'll sample one from the story section. Maggie Lind of Bethel tells us how the crane got blue eyes.
One time the crane was walking along and he was going to eat some berries, so he took his eyes off and put them on a stump and he said, "If someone comes along, you must holler to me and tell me that somebody's coming." So he went out and started eating berries, and after a while he was eating berries, the eyes said, "Master, somebody's coming and they're going to take us away." So he quickly ran down to the river and put on his eyes and looked, and it was only a wood drifting along. And so he put them back there again and says, "Don't you tell me no more stories after this." So he went back and he ate some more berries, but after a while the eyes were starting. He said, "Master, somebody's going to take us away." And he got further and further away. So after a while, he went down and looked for his eyes, and somebody had taken them away. So he went back into tundra, and he found cranberries, and he put them for his eyes, but everything was too red. And he took blackberries and put them for his eyes, and everything was too dark. So he found blueberries and he put them on, and everything was just nice. And ever since, the crane has blue eyes.
Do you know of any other projects like this that SOHIO has done or maybe is doing?
Well, we're very interested in doing what we can to help perpetuate the culture. We have funded the Juno Centennial Totem Pole Project. That's going to result in two totems 40 feet long. One was carved this last late summer and early fall by Nathan Jackson in Juneau, and it's dedicated to the Wushkaton clan or tribe of the raven. And I think that's right. I hope I'm right on that. And the other one will be done this next summer, and those two will be erected. One will be erected this spring, the one that is carved, and the one that's carved next summer should be erected the following spring. That's one project. We have been working with the Kawarik group in Nome we funded some reindeer warble fly research. So there are different ways of going about extending the culture. You can do it through the arts, as this was done, and as the Totem Project deals in the arts areas, or again with maintaining the culture through the use of the animals. And other than that, we're into so many things with taking basketball into the interior and out into the villages. That's part of the new lifestyle of the Eskimo youth and the Alaska Native youth, I should say, because we do get into all areas of the state with that.
That was Carolyn Dowling, Community Relations Specialist with SOHIO's Public Relations Office. Having a record and book like this one of Alaskan Eskimo songs and stories is good PR for SOHIO, and it's also nice to listen to. So we'll end with a story with songs told by Paul Green, who is from Kotzebue and Nome. The book says it's about three brothers who performed a most unusual feat by singing a magic song.
Once upon a time, there was a family living in the river, and there were three brothers, and they had no sisters around. And finally, they had some kind of a sickness there at their homes. They're the only family living, and the both parents was died. And these three brothers, they were thinking about to become some kind of an animal and so they could get away from their place, because they had gotten their parents, both of their parents was died, so nobody to left behind. So the older brothers was wishing, so he would become a wolf. So he starts singing. Sulungato wanilangato. Sulungato wanilangato. Ama ulungato wanilangato. Woohoo! So this young man was wishing to become a wolf, so he went out from the cabin as became a wolf. He went out. And then the second brothers, he was wishing that he would become a red fox. So he started singing to the same tune of a song. Sulungato wanilangato. Sulungato wanilangato. Kayok tulungato wanilangato. So he went out as a fox, red fox. So him two brothers was waiting for their younger brothers. And then this younger brothers, he was wishing, he was thinking about to wishing what he should be. And he think about the raven, so he wants to become a raven. So he starts singing the same tune and starts singing. Sulungato wanilangato. Sulungato wanilangato. Tulungato wanilangato. So he went out as a crow. So them two brothers, three brothers start off. And that the first brother was a, became a wolf, and the second brothers became a fox. They were running, and this raven, younger brothers, he was flying over them, watching. So finally they saw a caribou, bunch of caribou, and this raven pointed to these to his brothers. He saw the caribou, and their older brother go after him and caught one caribou. He didn't go very far chasing that caribou. He caught it. That wolf caught it. And after he kills it, these three brothers get together, and the older brother said, how are we going to do with this caribou? If we skin the caribou, this human, when the human found it, he will use that skin for something, for the use for the for his family. And that second brother, acting the same way, it'll be nice if we skin this caribou so them people will use it for something. Finally, this younger brother that became a raven, he said, if we skin this caribou skin and lay him there on the side after we skin it and eat the meat, and when somebody, when the human found it, they will be just using the skin for nothing. And then what we get? We get nothing. We better just eat that caribou, just tear up the skin and eat it. So they did. And they said if that youngest brother, Raven, if he say yes that time to these wolves and Red Fox, the time when they first caught a wolf, he said that the people would find a skin, stretch it out by those animals, and then it'll be useful for the natives. But the younger brother told his brothers not to do like that, just tear up the skin so nobody could use it for anything. So that's the end of the story.
From the record of Alaskan Eskimo songs and stories compiled and recorded by Lorraine de Coranda, we heard a welcome song by Charlie Jensen and Lucy Jensen of Northwest Alaska, the ancient King Loon song from John O'Rana of King Island, the story of How the Crane Got Blue Eyes by Maggie Lind of Bethel, and Three Brothers by Paul Green, who's from Kotzebue and Nome. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook. I'm Paula Schiller. Today we're beginning a series that we hope is being heard sometime during the holiday season in December or January, when it's dark and cold up north and only a little less so down south. When it might be easier to imagine yourself in the Eskimo village of Wainwright in winter, in tune with the weather, the stars, the moon, and the animals. Richard Nelson is an anthropologist who lived in Wainwright and has translated that experience into the most human and respectful terms in a book called The Shadow of the Hunter. It's a collection of stories that take place in Ulleronik, the Inupiaq name of Wainwright. The action follows the seasonal activity, and the characters are modeled on people Nelson lived with and hunted with. From the book, we can learn how much most of us don't know about the Arctic and how much the Inupiaq do. From Nelson himself, we can learn how one young man bridged the cultures and has been faithful in telling us what he gained from his Eskimo teachers. The stories in Shadow of the Hunter do not have chapters and numbers. Rather, they are separated into months, following the traditional Inupiaq method of reckoning the lunar cycle, the moon of the returning sun, the moon for bleaching skins, the moon when whaling begins, the moon with no sun.
The interesting thing about the moon is that even through the middle of the winter, when the sun isn't there, there are the cycles of moonlight. So that during the midwinter, in the night, which is the blackest night conceivable, if the moon is present, especially the full moon, you can go out and the whole landscape is illuminated. So much so that you could even take a book or a newspaper outside and read it by the moonlight. Not only the brilliance of the moon in this extremely clear northern air, but also the snow, the whole landscape being covered with snow so that this light is reflected, causes it to be almost like a lesser kind of a day. So despite the absence of the sun, there is light not only during the twilight of midday, but also during the moonlight of night. The moon during the wintertime actually is elevated to a much higher level of importance than we're accustomed to in our own culture, where we have artificial light and all this. And so the people watch the moon, and they're very acutely aware of what phase it's in. And as the phase of the moon gets toward its end, they'll start saying, the moon is getting lazy now, and talking about the moon just having enough energy to get a little above the horizon and then disappear. And of course, it's a sad time. It's disappointing to see the moon going like that, because you know you're going to have a much larger measure of darkness when the moon is gone.
Would the people hunt at night?
No.
When the moon is up?
When I lived in Wainwright, which was before the time when snow machines had come to the north, people only traveled by dog team, and so there was no source of light for them when they were traveling. And there was a real strong feeling about hunting at night that it was not a good thing to do. Too dangerous, too much chance to happen onto something, either physical or perhaps metaphysical, that you wouldn't want to happen on in the night.
You lived in Wainwright for 14 months and had experience with all the moons, and it seems from reading your book anyway that most of your experience was hunting, or is that just the experience you chose to write about?
Well, the subject of my study that I was doing there as a sort of an apprentice anthropologist at the time, I had just had one semester of graduate work in anthropology, was to study Eskimo hunting. And I had a contract from the United States Air Force, actually, to learn about Eskimo hunting and write down their methods of survival in order for pilots who should happen to crash on the sea ice or make emergency landings on the sea ice could know something about how to survive. And recognizing that Eskimos are the ultimate authorities on the subject of Arctic survival, it was a natural thing to do, to go and learn from them. So the focus of the stories is pretty strongly on hunting because it's what I was focused on, I suppose you'd say professionally, but also because it's what I was focused on personally. So much of my life centered around hunting. In fact, I lived almost entirely as a hunter in this community where I spent the year, had my own dog team, and was a semi-independent hunter. I always tried to hunt with somebody else, both for for the sake of learning and also for the sake of safety. But the stories focus on that because my knowledge is so focused.
Had you been a hunter before you came
to Inuit? No, I had never hunted at all before I went to live with the Eskimos. In fact, I was always kind of opposed to the idea of hunting because I was an animal lover since I was a little kid. But from the Eskimo people, I learned a whole different approach to animals in which you can love them no less than you did before, and in fact even more, because now you're living on them, from them. And so it was an interesting sort of a philosophical experience for me to go from someone who had never killed animals to a person who was sort of living by killing animals. And I still don't hunt an awful lot, but it changed my life in that I try to hunt as much as I can for my own living now, but I try to do it with the same kind of respectful feelings that my Eskimo teachers did.
How did you learn those feelings, though? It wasn't there the first time you saw an animal killed or killed an animal yourself, was it?
Well, no, I don't know what kind of subliminal learning goes on when you're involved in such incredibly intense experiences as I was when I lived with the Eskimos. Suddenly you go through a whole shift in your mental outlook where you look at animals differently. And the people you're with are obviously looking at animals differently. They talk about animals compulsively, almost constantly. Animals are the subject of discussion. And so animals are elevated to a level of importance in your life that you never experienced before, even if you were very interested in them. And yet the whole temper of the discussion of animals is different. You know, it's about what they are and what they're like and how they behave, but it's also about getting them, you know, capturing them and bringing them home and using them. And so your mind goes through a whole transformation. But I can't tell you exactly how it happens. It happens because of the whole environment that you're so absorbed in at this point. And I was extremely absorbed in it, living by myself in a community of Inupiaq Eskimo people. The whole existence that I led there was one of total absorption in this way of life.
And part of what I expect you've tried to do in the book, The Shadow of the Hunter, which is stories. It's not what you as an anthropologist would probably write for a thesis or for other anthropologists. They are stories, but I expect you've tried to convey some of your own transformation of and how the Eskimos feel about animals without pounding a reader on the head saying, this is what the Eskimos think. And that's kind of a tall order because even with your experience, you don't really know what the Eskimos think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good point. One of the things that I am most forcefully aware of from having had this experience of living with Eskimo people and subsequently with Athabaskan people in Alaska is that the cultural worlds in which we live are so vastly different, and they determine our way of thinking and seeing the world at such a deep level that it leaves a kind of a chasm between us as members of different cultures that we never can really cross. And I suppose in writing Shadow the Hunter, the areas in which I was least certain of what I was saying was where I was trying to get the most deeply into the way someone from the Eskimo culture was thinking. And yet, again, thinking about subliminal learning, I think you somehow, something absorbs in through your skin that gives you at least a sense, at least some approximation of how people are thinking, because you're with them so mm-hmm. constantly, and you're seeing so much of the visual manifestations of how people think.
Why did you write the book? I've hazarded my guess.
Well, the principal reason for me in writing this book was because as an anthropologist, I've been involved with writing sort of the analytical accounts of people in which you sort of dissect and pull apart their way of life and order it differently as you put it back together. Always left me unsatisfied because although you could learn something about people, something important about people through these accounts, you didn't come away with a feeling of, mm-hmm. well, what are Eskimo people like? And so a big part of my motivation was to try to communicate those more almost ethereal dimensions of what Eskimo people are like. And to communicate also a feeling for what the environment they live in is like. And to do this, I felt that you had to kind of take the raw material of experience and try to reproduce it in words. So that a person who is reading about Eskimo hunting is then going out, in a sense, with you on a hunt and experiencing all of these things happening at the same time that take place when you hunt.
In Shadow of the Hunter, Nelson takes the reader on many hunts, sometimes with families, with a whaling crew, or with a remarkable older hunter who seemed to feel in his bones every change in weather, every shift in ice, and he can even sense the presence of animals a long way away.
When he had finished eating, Sakeak lay back and closed his eyes, listening to the young man's hunting stories. Sakeak was 70 years old, but he was still almost as lively as a boy. His face was narrow and bony, with crow's feet at the corners of his eyes, and his broad smile was almost permanent. Everyone knew he was the greatest living hunter in Ulawunik, and despite his years, he still never missed a chance to be out in pursuit of game. Sakeak's knowledge of animals was legendary, but there was something beyond this as well, because he seemed to possess the ancestral gift of sensing what went on in an animal's mind. Several of the men lapsed into sleep, but some remained awake, talking late into the night. Talimat was in the midst of a long story about seal hunting when Sakeak had a peculiar feeling, a ringing in his ears that sometimes happened when game was nearby. He sat up and spoke. "I think a whale is coming, and perhaps it will surface very close to our camp." Nauruk, who was accustomed to the old man's extraordinary senses, pulled on his parka and said he had better go out and have a look. Talimat awoke the others, and eventually they all followed. On his way to the lookout, Nauruk saw Migalik, the only man on watch, slouched in the stern of the Umiak, sound asleep. He climbed the hummock and stood watching for less than a minute, then pointed south excitedly and ran down to the others. "Whale coming," he whispered breathlessly. "Whale coming. Just down the lead, not far from the edge. We will need the Umiak." No one said another word. In a matter of seconds, they surrounded the boat and slid it off the ice so gently it hardly made a ripple. "Paddle up the lead toward the north," Sakeak directed in a soft but confident voice. "Otherwise, it may pass by us underwater." The men stroked at half speed, dipping their paddles carefully so they made almost no sound.
In our next program, which will be a special reading, Dick Nelson takes us out with Sakeak the Hunter onto the sea ice after seal. For Chinook, I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.